Okay, I'm recording. We have a lot of short news topics. Let me see what I've got here. I sent this to you about 30 minutes before we started recording. Carter Page sues Yahoo, HuffPost, parent companies for false and defamatory articles. So it looks like Carter Page is finally making his moves. We said he was going to do something way back when we started to cover this, that Carter Page, number one, was treated absolutely just, I don't even want to say poorly. They destroyed his life, these media companies. Mm-hmm. And we always said, we hope he sues. We hope he does something. He's coming out with a book. That's number one. But he's going after Yahoo, the HuffPost. And I think he's got a very, very good case, especially Alexander, on the back of the rulings with Nick Sandman and the kids from Covington Catholic. Mm-hmm. And how he won against CNNs and all these big media companies. He won big, mm-hmm. Sandman, and now you have Carter Page going after them.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's done exactly the right thing. I wish him well. I think he was appallingly treated. I have, by the way, dare I say, Carter Page a little on my conscience, because when I first learned about this, I was very heavily influenced by these news media stories about him. I never believed that he was ever, ever involved in any kind of collusion, but I thought that he probably was exaggerating his role and had been a bit of a Walter Mitty, and I called him that, and it was completely not true, and I take it entirely back. And I want to say that I've said it before, but I'll say it again, he is one of the great victims of the Russiagate hoax. I mean, he was shafted by the FBI. An FBI lawyer changed information in an email from the CIA to make it seem as if he was not somebody who'd helped the United States intelligence community with Russia, when in fact he had. And he was placed under what was clearly, in my opinion, unlawful surveillance, and all sorts of terrible stories about him were spread through the media, which were never researched properly. Those stories were completely untrue. They, as I said, damaged his reputation. Even for a skeptical person like me, I mean, I was influenced by them to the extent that I called him what I said I did. So I think he is entirely justified in bringing these claims. And I predict all of these claims will settle for substantial amounts of money, and he deserves it. And, you know, I think he's entirely, entirely in the right to do it. By the way, I would add, where Carter Page did something Carter Page also did, was that he acted for himself in all his meetings with the FBI. He represented himself when he went to Congress. He didn't instruct lawyers. He just went ahead, sat down, told the truth. He was never prosecuted. Mueller couldn't find anything against him, couldn't even find a fabricated case against him. So he is far from being a Walter Mitty. He comes across as an extremely clever man.
Yeah, good for him. I hope he wins. I hope he wins big against Yahoo and the Huffington Post and other media. Other media companies, which I think he will go after.
I think he will, and I think he will win against all of them, because the things that were said about him were terrible. I mean, it was clearly made out that he was some kind of Russian asset, Russian agent, when he was an American patriot who did have business with Russia, but who was also a source of information, a valued source of information about Russia, for the US intelligence community, and specifically for the CIA. So what was being said about him was not just untrue, it was the opposite of the truth. So good for him for bringing this case, and I wish him well.
Yeah, he served his country, and he was treated absolutely, just absolutely shameful. Just kind of, I don't know, you know, Carter Page reminds me of like one of those guys in cinema or in film. I can't think of a movie right now off the top of my head, but one of those guys who's just an innocent guy, and just walking down the street, has nothing to do with anything, but, you know, these intelligence agencies or these evil villains pluck them out from the crowd, decide to pin something on the person so that they can get to a bigger target. That was Carter Page. He did nothing. They just plucked him out from the crowd. They said, this is who we're going to target. This is who we're going to allege did X, Y, and Z, and that'll help us get Trump and the Trump campaign.
And
he did nothing wrong.
He did nothing wrong, And the FBI knew that he did nothing wrong, so they lied about him to the FISA court. They actually changed one of the emails, as I said, from the CIA, which said that, you know, this Batman is a valuable resource. He's been a source for up to the CIA. And they changed it to say that he had not been a source for the CIA, when in fact he had. So they lied about him to the FISA court. And as you absolutely rightly said, they did that. They picked him. They picked on him in order to get at Donald Trump. No other reason. A patriotic, loyal, honest American treated in this despicable way.
So evil. They're so
evil. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And they don't apologize even today. Oh, no. They don't apologize.
Oh, no, no. You still get rumblings of suggestions, you know, that, you know, Carter Page is this rather odd person, you know, who's got a bee in his bonnet and, you know, screwies here and there. None of which was true. Absolutely none of which was true.
You told me the UK media is still pushing the Russiagate, yeah, Alexander. They're still pushing it.
To an amazing extent. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, The Guardian, first and foremost. I was reading an article on the opinion pages of The Guardian, an op-ed by, I think it was Carol Cadwallader, who is one of the sort of arch people who sees Russia in everything. And, you know, she was still talking about, you know, as if Russian interference in the US, the whole Russiagate thing, had been proved. When in fact it's not been proved, it's been refuted. I mean, this is what's so bizarre about all of this. But there it is. I mean, you know, the media in Britain has not publicized the information that we all know about Steele, about the mistreatment of Carter Page, about the FISA abuse, about the revelations from CrowdStrike, from, you know, the fact that they weren't actually sure that it was the Russians, the collapse of the case against the St. Petersburg troll farm. None of that's been covered or explained or debated here. It just doesn't exist.
Incredible. Mm. All right. Let's see. Two stories on big tech. Let's talk a little big tech, and then we'll shift gears to talk a little bit about Turkey and Greece and Cyprus. But first, big tech. Twitter locked out Trump Jr. From his account because Trump tweeted a video which we probably can't even talk about and can't say, because we'll probably get suspended or demonetized or deplatformed or
whatever.
What else to do with us? Who knows? Send 30 FBI agents to our door. But anyway, there's this video going viral on the CV, and interesting video. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump Jr. retweeted it. And commented on it, and Twitter locked him out. At the same time, Alexander, we have, I believe, tomorrow. So today is Tuesday evening. I believe, yes, tomorrow, Wednesday. So when this video goes up, it'll probably be the same day that you have the top CEOs from big tech going to the House, going to Congress to testify on a hearing that will cover antitrust law and big tech's relationship with Washington. Those CEOs, by the way, Alexander, are Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Tim Cook of Apple, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, and Sundar Pichai of Google. So you have, on the one hand, little tech company like Twitter and Jack Dorsey banning Donald Trump Jr. for a tweet. And on the flip side, you have tomorrow the big fish of the Silicon Valley pond going before Congress to talk antitrust and big tech's relationship with Washington. What do you make of these stories?
Well, first of all, let's deal with Donald Trump Jr. You know, you may disagree completely with Donald Trump Jr.'s take on the particular issue discussed in this video, which I'm not going to talk about either, what that video was in the video. But you know, you might completely disagree, but let me say this very clearly. I mean, as far as I can see, in fact, I can say definitely, no laws were broken. He didn't do anything that was illegal. There's no suggestion that he did. So if you disagree with him, why not simply respond to what he says? Isn't that what free speech is supposed to be? One person puts one view, the other person puts another view, and the public decide. I mean, you know, they're supposed to be well informed. This is supposed to be a democracy. Free speech is supposed to apply. Isn't this what's supposed to happen? Who are Twitter to decide otherwise. Now, they say they are a private company and they can regulate whatever appears on their site. Fine, you're a publisher, with all that means and implies, then you can do that. But you cannot, in that case, simultaneously function, as Twitter does, as an essential monopoly in this kind of field, because in that case you're abusing your monopoly power, and you should not be given the kind of protections that the law gives you. I mean, there's all this legislation that they've been hiding behind, which means that they're not liable in that case for the kind of things they publish. So I said, you know, I've said this so many times, I'm going to say it again. Either you are a platform, either you are, you know, a sort of notice board in which people can put their whatever they think, which is what Twitter claims it is, or you are a publisher. You cannot be both at the same time. If you're being both at the same time, you're having, legally speaking, your cake and eating it as well. And what you're doing in that case is you're giving yourself extraordinary power to censor and regulate and police, and you're not accountable for it. And that seems to me completely wrong. Power without responsibility. One of our prime ministers in Britain, Stanley Baldwin, once described the media in Britain in that way. He said, power without responsibility. I'm quoting his words now, just you know, to be very clear. He said, that is the prerogative of the harlot. So there you go.
Well said. And the big tech CEO's antitrust law, relationship with Washington. Their relationship with Washington, an interesting way to phrase it.
Well, indeed, and you know, perhaps one that flows very well from the kind of comment that Stanley Baldwin was making. Let's be very clear about this. Big tech has got very close to the political system. They are completely involved in it, and they have an agenda that is very, very much bound up with that of the political system, or at least with certain people who function within the political system. They have pursued, I'm going to say it frankly, a partisan agenda over the last 4 years during the lifetime of the Trump presidency, which it is becoming impossible for anybody who looks at this to deny. And as the election looms in November, that partisan agenda has been conducted ever more aggressively. Not before time they've been called to explain their position to Congress. Remember, it is Congress which has provided them with the legal protections and privileges that they have. So it is time, coming back to what Baldwin said, that they were held accountable to what they have been doing with all those privileges and responsibilities and powers that Congress gave them. It seems to me that they have not been exercising those powers responsibly or in good faith.
I saw an interview with Bill Gates, and it was on another topic, a health topic, which I will not mention because of various censorship issues. And anyway, during the interview, they asked Bill Gates about the CEOs going in front of Congress. And obviously, Bill Gates has the history with Microsoft and the antitrust issues he had with Microsoft. And they asked him about it. And Bill Gates didn't comment much, but he said, you know, I wish them luck. It's going to be tough. But I thought to myself, if you had to take a look at these CEOs, Amazon, Apple, Google, which company would you say probably violates the antitrust laws out of these big, powerful tech companies?
I mean, I would say the two ones that are out of control. are Google and Facebook. I mean,
Google and Facebook.
they function essentially as gatekeepers for the English language internet. I mean, you know, you can't escape them, especially Google, dare I say. You go to, if you want to go to the internet, you have to go through, 90%, 99% of people go through Google.
What about the fact that Bezos and Amazon are directly connected to a publication like the Washington Post? Bezos owns the Washington Post. Do you see a conflict with that?
Absolutely.
Is that right?
No, I don't think it is right. I don't think it's right at all. I think it's completely inappropriate. I think it's a massive abuse. And I'm not saying that because I think, you know, some companies, Google and Facebook, have, you know, more power than others, that the others, I'm not giving the other companies, Amazon and Bezos, you know, a clean card. Not at all. I think absolutely inappropriate and wholly wrong that Bezos owns the Washington Post. I think this is a completely inappropriate thing. I think it is completely wrong that Amazon has this massive control now of, you know, distribution of published material. I mean, you know, most books now, as far as I can tell, I mean, are sold through Amazon. I mean, it's a very unhealthy state of affairs. I mean, again, it's a monopoly, essentially. And one should, American system has always been geared against monopoly. Of course it's a monopoly. And again, I feel, as somebody who is opposed to monopolies, that it needs to be, there's clear antitrust issues there, and it needs to be broken up. That's my own personal view. Clearly there is. If you go after Rockefeller because he, through Standard Oil, corners the market in oil, back in before the First World War, then I mean Amazon is doing the same thing on an even bigger scale now with books and all sorts of other things.
I mean, I guess the legal loophole, I don't know if it's a legal loophole, you know better, is the fact that Amazon is one entity, but the Washington Post is owned personally by Jeff Bezos. That's his own personal ownership.
I do understand that, but I mean, you know, in that case, you see, this is where the issue of Amazon becomes important, because Amazon is a virtual monopoly. So you are saying that the person who controls and owns that virtual monopoly of one form of publishing should at the same time have power over the nation's biggest newspapers. That is a concentration of power which I think is extremely unhealthy in a democracy, and which in a proper functioning democracy should not be allowed. By the way, in saying this, in America, the America of 30, 40 years ago, it would have been a no-brainer. This would not have happened. This would not have been possible.
Oh, they went after Microsoft and they succeeded.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that, you know, I think in time, I don't know how long it will take, but I think in time it will happen to these guys. As I said, they are, all of these companies, they are a cartel of oligarchs. They're a cartel of oligarchical monopolies.
All right.
Between themselves, they've divided up various sections of the media. And they collude with each other, exactly. Well, that's what a cartel does. Cartel colludes. And they each help each other to maintain the dominant position each has carved out in a particular part of the internet.
Yeah. On a side note, you know that Matt Gaetz is going after Zuckerberg. He actually filed a criminal indictment. He did something. I forgot the story, but I think he did file a criminal. What's the word that I'm looking for?
A criminal complaint?
A criminal complaint or something against Zuckerberg for perjury or something along those lines. Perjured himself.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll dig up the story.
Absolutely. It sounds very interesting. Let's find out about it.
That is true. I mean, Gaetz is going after Zuckerberg for his testimony.
Well, you know, what do they say? That there really is no honor amongst thieves. So let's find out more about this. I'd be very interested to know.
Yeah. All right. And then finally, real quickly, real quick. We have Turkey issues a new NAV text to send Barbaros in Cypriot EEZ. In other words, the Turks are sending a ship for oil and gas exploration into the Eastern Mediterranean, into the Cyprus exclusive economic zone, not the Greek, the Cyprus. Just to give a follow-up, Alexander, to our previous video that we did covering this topic with Turkey and Libya and the oil and gas exploration and Greece and France and Macron and all those things that are going on in the Mediterranean, it so happened that when Greece deployed their navy into the region to stop Turkey from moving into the region, Turkey backed down and moved its ships back to its port in Turkey onto the mainland. So Greece called Erdogan's bluff. Erdogan moved back, and that's that. But Turkey is now going to move forward with ships into Cyprus. Is he easy? Interesting.
Yes, it is very interesting, but it's also very typical of Erdogan. So he meets a rebuff with the Greeks, who, you know, by the standards of the region, have advanced and powerful armed forces. This is an aspect of Greece which isn't widely known, but Greece has a very strong air force and a very strong navy. Cyprus is, of course, a weaker country in military terms. I mean, it's got many other qualities. It's got a very strong financial system, but it doesn't have the kind of armed forces that Greece has. So what Erdogan does is he withdraws when his bluff is called by the stronger party, and now he's probing against the weaker party. And he knows that Cyprus and Greece are very close. So he's hoping by doing that also, I am sure, to cause strains between them. So this is very much the way that he works. So you see this again, you saw it with Syria, for example, when he ran into opposition in Syria from the Russians. He then switched attention to Libya. Now he's finding problems with Libya. So he goes after Iraq. He does this all the time. And he's doing this again in the Eastern Mediterranean. He ran up against Greece, pulled back against Greece when it began to look rather tricky for him. The French were also, of course, making strong comments, and they're a strong ally of Greece. So now he's going after Cyprus, and we'll see whether Greece and France have the wisdom to stand by Cyprus, which, of course, it is very much in the interests of Greece and of France and of Europe that they should do.
I wonder if Putin had a word with him as well. Calm down.
Interesting you say that, because they did actually have a conversation a short time ago, one of many. I mean, poor Putin has to listen to, has to feel conversations with Erdogan all the time. But they did have a conversation, and it's quite likely they did cover the point. They would definitely have covered the issue. So it's possible he did tell him to calm down. But whatever the background to it, as I said, he withdraws in one place in order to advance another. It doesn't alter the fact that he remains a destabilizing force to the countries that surround Turkey. And of course, we were discussing this shortly before we did this program. There's been pressure on the Turkish lira that, of course, feeds into pressures in the Turkish economy, which is very import dependent. That will lead to inflation in Turkey. Situation in Turkey economically is less good than it to Erdogan would like it. So that gives him an extra incentive to rally his base by taking these kind of moves.
Yeah. And it's also a lesson for Greece, because they called his bluff with the migrant issue up north at Evros, and they called his bluff and he backed down.
Yes.
And they now called his bluff in the Mediterranean with the EEZ. And he backed down. So I think for Mitsotakis and the Greek government, this is a lesson that when Erdogan makes these moves, don't back down like Tsipras did the previous government. Confront it. You know, make your move. Be just as boisterous and, you know, as aggressive. Mm. And Erdogan eventually will retreat. That's the moral.
This is absolutely true. And I would also add that Mitsotakis, I've been critical of Mitsotakis on many things, many times, but he actually also did the diplomacy well. I mean, he spoke to the French, who are important friends of Greece, and he called Putin in Russian. I mean, he also telephoned Putin. So, you know, he made sure that his diplomatic back was covered with the French and the Russians. And at the same time, he took a strong line. And as you rightly said, Erdogan pulled back. Erdogan does pull back. As I said, he never pushes. He pushes as far as he feels he can go. He risks sometimes overreaching. But at the end of the day, he doesn't like to get into a confrontation that he can't control. He didn't want to take on the Russians in Syria. He's pulling back now, it seems, from taking on the Egyptians in Libya. And we've seen that in the Eastern Mediterranean, he's not particularly keen to take on the Greeks either. So that's how you need to deal with this. But, you know, always bear in mind that if he's pushed back in one place, he will try and advance in another. So you've got to be consistently firm with him. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yeah, Angela Merkel knows that because she's never been firm with him.
Well, that's entirely true.
She's got it rocked all over.
Well, all the time, exactly. Yeah.
All right, let's end it there. You got a mug? I've got the USA mug, by the way. Go to our shop, guys, at the Durant Shop.
I've actually got our own mug.
Oh, yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, which is a great one, I think. But tea, by the way, Kimun tea from China, for anybody who wants to know. It's one of the Chinese black teas. So it's a great tea and a great mug.
All right. All right, guys, take care.